This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Need is a national standard of it's all heads or it's all tails.
Oh, look who's in favor of a national standard now.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Scott Walker of the education policy community, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike.
You know, you were like Governor Walker before there was a Governor Walker. You've been tough loving it for at least a decade.
And I got to say, one of the least impressive things about Governor Walker is this kabuki dance where he and his people seem reluctant to actually acknowledge that the reason you rein in collective bargaining for public employees is not to help solve this year's budget shortfall, but to change the dynamic going forward. They won't say it. It's appalling. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
The only time I'm sympathizing.
But it's still, right. But you're still saying, right, it's still about reining in budgets.
Of course it is.
To say the reason we got into this mess was because we have allowed unions to collectively bargain with boards that they help elect. And so, surprise, they've put things in that are not sustainable.
Well, that's right. And the incentives are for politicians to give away goodies and kick the bill down the road. And a Walker should be out talking bluntly and forcefully about this.
Right.
Instead, they keep trying to somehow say that these substantial changes are needed to address the shortfall of the next year or two, which puts them on real weak footing.
Now, the smart thinking says, according to the New York Times editorial board, that, yes, unions should provide concessions in Wisconsin and elsewhere, but we shouldn't end collective bargaining as we know it.
Of course not. What the Times suggested we do is say very firmly to the unions, you need to give concessions.
Right. And then, well, they'll do it, right?
Well, the Times didn't really get into that.
All right. And then you were also saying you're not so happy with Richard Kallenberg lately, or is he speaking the truth? good friend of ours, by the way.
A good friend of ours.
Yes.
He's discovered the truth that an easy way to rack up points in the ed debate is to say what millions of teachers want to hear, which is people who are talking about tenure reform and evaluation reform are meanies.
Right.
And that Democrats who have talked about things like tenure and evaluation reform are meanies who have paved the way for the villains who are trying to take away unaffordable benefits.
Right, whereas we villains say that we're paving the way for the Democratic reformers to get tenure reform and the like.
And what's really funny is that the Democratic reformers who have been so busy trying to triangulate Clinton style off of the Walkers are now being thrown in the same wheelbarrow by Kallenberg and Ravitch. It's all really interesting.
It's good. Look at us. We're not even bantering about pop culture. We got right into the substance right away here on the Education Gadfly Show. We got a lot to cover. We're going to play Pardon the Gadfly, Amber's Research Minute. We're going to hear Chris Irvine's What's Up With That. So let's get started. We've got Janie here with us today to play Pardon the Gadfly.
Question one. A bipartisan group of education leaders has announced support for a common curriculum. Is this curriculum a good or a bad idea?
Whoa. Let's back up. Bipartisan. Mike, I presume you wrote the question. And a bipartisan group, you mean the Al Shanker Institute, or the AFT's think tank, issued this with a number of Finland-centric luminaries like Linda Darling Hammond, and a couple of token, borderline irrelevant former Republican governors, and our buddy Checker, who somehow, Mike, you got to explain to me, got roped into signing this thing.
So I like that it's Finland-centric and Finn. Good. Okay, so it all ties together here. It's bipartisan. There were a handful of Republicans that signed on.
It
doesn't have to be by, you know, when somebody says it's bipartisan, it doesn't mean it has to be, you know, split down the middle 50-50.
No. But there's 75 people, and explain to me exactly who. Look, and let's not even go bipartisan. Tell me the folks who we think of as tough-minded school reformers.
Checker.
Did Joe Williams sign on? Joel Klein?
Checker.
Michelle Rhee?
Checker.
Who speaks for the reform community? John Schnur.
Checker.
John Schnur on there.
John Schnur speaks for the reform community.
Who speaks?
He's a tough-minded reformer.
That's what I'm saying.
I like John, but
This is what I'm saying. The slice of education reformers that this represents is so incredibly narrow and specific
but Rick,
their massive Finland and Singapore envy that to suggest it's anything more than a thin cloak for nationalized curricula is ludicrous.
You've got this so wrong in this one. Okay. Look, this is more telling about the school reform community. Committee. The reason that the Joe Williams and others of the world don't touch this is because none of them are talking about curriculum. They're all talking about structural reform.
They all support a Common Core.
But they're all talking about structural reform,
okay,
right?
Okay, is Bobby Jindal on here? Is Mitch Daniels? Any of these Republican governors who've supported Common Core, where are they on this document?
I'm not sure if they were asked.
Uh-huh. Oh, actually, Mike, I think that might be more instructive than anything. Who these guys even thought to ask to sign their petition?
Look, let's talk about the substance of this a little bit.
All right. Yes.
Hey, is a voluntary national curriculum a good idea or a bad idea?
Mike, does this say that skeptics have got to get over their fear of national curriculum and the rest, and we've got to get serious about larding on top of these voluntary national standards a set of quasi-mandatory tests and curricula?
Okay.
And learning instructional materials?
You are really fired up about this.
I feel that people have been massively misled, that this is exactly what skeptics, folks who I don't always agree with, like Neil McCluskey and Jay Green, exactly what they said what was being sold to people. They were not only told they were wrong, they were hit hard by folks who said, this is crazy paranoia. And now we're not even 12 months down this road, and this is exactly what they had expressed concerns about.
Let's unpack this a little bit, if we can keep our voices down.
Right? Mm-hmm. Mikey.
I love it. You're actually fired up.
I am fired up.
Ooh, baby. Look, first of all, I mean, Checker's been on the record forever saying that he supports national curriculum. I mean, there was a debate in Education Next, 3 years ago at least, if not four, making the case for national curriculum. I forget. Who did he debate on that one?
I don't even recall.
Was it Linda Darling-Hammond? See, that's the funny thing. It might have been. Maybe not. Okay.
I tend to doubt that.
We'll check that. All right. But so this is nothing new. The other thing is it's voluntary. I mean, nobody is saying that we're going to...
Okay, the feds are giving $300 million.
Would you let me finish? Okay. Nobody is going to say that we're going to mandate that all 100,000 schools are going to teach the same curriculum. Believe me, I would not be in support of that. Okay. I'm sending my kid to a Waldorf preschool, for God's sake. I mean, I don't want him to have to go to a public school someday and, you know, would everybody has to learn the same thing. I believe in choice. So does Checker. Mm-hmm. The question is, what we have is we have standards getting developed and assessments. And what we know from standards-based reform, and here I think Randy Weingarten and the AFT have legitimate concerns, is we put out the standards, we put out the tests, and then we don't do a good job giving teachers something that they can use if they want to help to teach those standards. And it seems like it might be a good idea to go through the process of getting the standards to the next level and saying, here's a curriculum that would work well with these standards. In fact, the Common Core, Lynn Munson's group, has already developed that in English, and we think it's pretty good. Why not have it on there? It does not mean that we're saying that each school in America has to teach that curriculum, Rick.
Right. It's just saying that you're devising standards and then assessments mapped onto those standards and then linking those assessments to suggested curricula and instructional materials. But nobody really expects that schools are going to feel any pressure or be held accountable for performance on these program elements.
They're going to be accountable for the results of the assessments. And if they
For instance, when we look at PARC, is a through course assessment. So every 9 weeks, for instance, when we look at mathematics instruction.
That's a problem.
You've got to. Oh, is it now? But you don't think devising a curriculum more broadly is a problem.
Greg Forster, hit us on this the other day about our zigzagging on this. And he laid it out pretty well that, you know, we believe it's okay to have national standards. We believe it's going to have national tests. We believe that there should be high stakes accountability attached to those national tests. We even believe that it's okay to have a voluntary national curriculum. Once you start assessing more than one time a year, though, then we got a big problem with it. Okay. Janie, next topic.
USA Today, along with a handful of other papers, reviewed test scores in 6 states and found some dramatic jumps in student achievement, potentially due to teacher cheating. What do the scores really say about the schools in question?
All right, so they found, I think the number was about 300 schools where they think the scores look questionable, that there's, you know, huge, you know, 3, 4, 5. Can you have changes of like 5 standard deviations? Is that possible? I mean, theoretically.
Phenomenal instruction.
Okay. So, you know, and they found some examples where yes, indeed, a teacher got busted. This one in Ohio, you know, got fired for basically, you know, looking at the test and giving his kids the questions the night before. But, you know, as other people pointed out, Chad Edelman at Education Sector, for example, look, we're talking about maybe 1% of the schools. I mean, we should expect there to be cheating, right? And what's the threshold? How much is more cheating than you'd expect?
Well, I mean, part of the issue here, though, is A, These, these schools, you know, if a school jumps two standard deviations, it's observationally equivalent whether it was remarkable instruction or whether they cheated. There's just no way to know. And if schools aren't increasing that much, it doesn't mean they're not cheating. Part of the problem with this exercise is all you're doing is you're looking at a bell curve of changes in school performance and arbitrarily saying that some threshold starts to feel suspicious. Well, any of these numbers could be suspicious. This exercise just doesn't add that much to the degree to which...
Well, hold on, but it's a legitimate question, right? This goes way back, right, to, just stand and deliver. I mean, that he was getting incredible results with AP with kids you wouldn't expect, and so they went in and investigated.
It goes back to the movie, and in research circles, it goes back to mid-last decade Chicago, where Brian Jacob did that work, identified, it looks like 4-6% of Chicago test scores appeared suspicious, if you look at response patterns and erasures and stuff. So yeah, I think this is part of the debate, right? That folks who are pro test-based accountability keep being naive about it and suggesting that nobody's going to cheat, which is silly. And critics make it sound as if any amount of cheating is disqualifying. And the reality is you're inevitably going to have a little bit of cheating, which raises concerns about exactly what's going on with educators when they're driving it. Mm-hmm. But the key is to make sure that it is an acceptable amount to discourage it and to address it appropriately.
So what's acceptable? That's my question. Look, let's say we find out that 1% of the schools or 1% of the teachers are cheating, and we set up safeguards to try to find them and to put them in jail or fire them, whatever we're allowed to do. I guess jail might be too harsh for that. I don't know. It seems like 1%, that's not so bad. I'm willing to accept that.
It's not so bad.
Okay.
I'm just not at all sure from this exercise that it's 1%.
Okay. Topic number 3, Janie.
The recent stopgap funding law cut $4 billion in spending, including federal earmarks to Teach for America. Should we be sad that these earmarks are going away?
Rick?
No.
Mike?
No.
That was easy. George Will, Mike, you saw George Will wrote a column about a week ago.
I guess. George Will.
Somebody from TFA had clearly reached him. And George Will, who has explained the problems with earmarking and how they undermine the incentives for legislators to rein in spending, went on a tirade about how TFA is a good earmark and how it's a different kind of earmark because it is a named program and not geographically specific. Mm-hmm. And there's all kinds of loopholes you open up if that becomes your criteria. Look, Congress should be in the habit, probably of spending less money on everything, since clearly they don't want to raise taxes to pay for it. And B, they ought to set criteria for spending these dollars. And if TFA qualifies under this criteria, terrific. But otherwise, so be it.
Yeah, some important context here. First of all, Teach for America just got a $50 million grant under the I-3 program. This is a $20 million or so earmark that they've been getting for several years now that goes into their sort of general operating fund to help them basically support more teachers. So it comes down to about 400 teachers a year. The thing is, this is not a competitive grant that they are getting. Yes, they, through their lobbyist, Kevin Huffman, who is now heading to Tennessee to be the commissioner of education down there, Kevin's done a good job making sure that they got this into a statute, into not just the budget bill, but into a statute, I think, into ESCA, basically saying, Teach for America is one of the programs we're going to support. And so it's a little bit better than an earmark that was put in the dark of the night and during the budget appropriations process, and nobody knows who put it in there and blah, blah, blah. But it's not that much better. Because it still says that if you want to get money from the federal purse, you hire a good lobbyist and you try to lobby to get it. A better system would be, hey, if we're going to have money going to a group like Teach for America, they should compete for it like everybody else. And guess what? When they compete, they win.
Otherwise, it's this named program thing says, hey, you know what? I got a neat program. My first job is to raise $500,000 to pay a couple of K Street lobbyists to spend their time working over our congressman to try to get ourselves written in. This is not healthy behavior.
And there's plenty of other. Look, National Writing Project is getting cut. Reading is fundamental. There's plenty of these other ones that, hey, they're fine. They're good. They do good things. They're fine to have. But there's no clear reason why the federal taxpayers should be spending their money on programs that are kind of nice and good to have. Programs that should probably be going to philanthropists who say, hey, I like this program, I'll spend my own money on it. I have to admit, though, the fact that Kevin Huffman is leaving TFA has made it easier for me to come right out and say that I'm not sad for it. Wendy has been very gracious to both of us. We were just invited to be at her 20th anniversary.
Yeah.
And so maybe we'll be hearing from her. But look,
there's a lot of people I like. Doesn't mean I want the government to earmark our tax dollars to their pockets.
Amen to that. Okay, that's all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. Thank you, Janie. Thank you, Rick, especially about being fired up on the common curriculum.
Thank you, Mike.
It is now time for Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the
show.
How
you doing?
I'm well. How about you?
I'm doing great.
I'm doing good too, guys.
Did we ask?
Rick, I'm not talking to you after that whole
clearly
core curriculum.
Little tension in the podcast today.
Okay, Amber, what you got for us today?
So this week, we're going to give a shout out to a report conducted by the FDR Group for our Fordham, Ohio office. This was a survey of Ohio soups, about 40% of them, which is pretty good for a response rate for this type of survey. Anyway, key finding is that Ohio will be hard-pressed to improve outcomes for students as long as principals are largely unable to control their budgets and have to deal with all sorts of dysfunction at the state level as well as contract clauses. So a few interesting findings. 52% of soups say the real problem in education is how and where money is spent, compared to 37% who say that it's not enough money being spent on schools. However, when asked to think about their own districts, and we've seen this in other surveys, the figures are reversed. 39% say the problem is how and where, and 50% say it's too little money. A whopping 78% favor linking their own pay to improve student outcomes in exchange for greater authority over managing staff. Primary ways they want to save money at the district level are combining state revenue streams, giving them greater flexibility over spending, and mandating a statewide health insurance plan. Imagine that. Cost cutters they don't like so much: merging school districts, giving districts more freedom to convert traditional schools to charter schools, and outsourcing or merging district back office operations. They are also not interested in trade-offs, whereby they might have more say over teacher compensation or hiring and dismissal in exchange for a 15% reduction in state funding. So there's still a mentality to protect funding, even if hypothetically you could be given greater authority.
Real profile and courage, isn't it, Rick?
I feel like we talked about these disheartening results last week, except that I felt like at that point you guys were trying to show more aggressively that this showed something good. Wasn't that the case?
Ooh, I wasn't here last week, so.
Yeah. No, look, it did show some good things, which is that they, for example, do want to see aggressive moves against collective bargaining. I mean, they do feel like they're at a disadvantage there.
Oh, maybe anonymously they say this, but of course in Wisconsin and elsewhere, superintendents have done the best they can to distance themselves
from
people who are pushing.
Because they have to work with these people, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Look, and I do like that they don't want to merge districts. I mean, that...
Or outsource back office. Or, yeah. Or,
I mean, keep in mind,
or accept charters.
I mean, this is, you know, 611 superintendents in Ohio. We got 40% of them to respond,
yeah,
which is pretty amazing. And, you know, a lot of these are, they got the superintendents of these tiny little districts that you think would need to combine forces. So... yes. Okay, Amber, what song is
this? All right. So the song, since these principals want to have more control, we have My Life by Billy Joel, one of our favorite podcast artists.
Got a call from an old friend. We used to be real close. Said he couldn't go on the American way. Closed the shop, sold the house, bought a ticket to the west.
Telling me that song was the theme song for a TV show?
Bosom Buddies, baby. Bosom Buddies. Do you remember this?
I do not. See, this makes it even a better song that Amber picked, because it's like Bosom Buddies, like superintendents and union leaders.
Wow.
Are Bosom
now,
Buddies.
There are, of course, two leads in Bosom Buddies.
Yes.
One, as we all know, was
Tom Hanks.
But who was the other?
I have no idea.
Nor do I.
Okay. All right. That brings us to Chris Irvine's What's Up With That?
To clear my head, telephone rang and you wanna chat. Well, sit on down and tell me what up with that. What up with that? Yes,
all right, well, stemming from all the recent hoopla in Madison and Columbus, I wanted to know a little bit more about the actual language of these seniority-based, collectively bargained contracts that are seemingly worth all this uproar. For instance, if two teachers have the exact same seniority, but only one needs to be fired, how do the last-hired, first-fired policies determine who stays and who goes? So I did some digging. What I found came as no surprise. Complete lunacy. If such a conundrum were to occur in Hartford, Connecticut, for example, do you know which teacher would be fired? Not the one with worse reviews by students, peers, or supervisors. That would be too arbitrary. The actual language is much more technical. Allow me to read it word for word. Quote, in case of a tie, seniority shall be determined by the last four digits of the teacher's social security number. The higher number shall have more seniority. End quote. Seriously? The last four digits of one's SSN? What's up with that? I found the same thing to be the case in Ann Arbor, Michigan. But wait, in Ann Arbor, whichever teacher's last four digit number is lower garners them more seniority. Yes, you heard me right. And no, this isn't the Gladfly episode. This nonsense is actually written into teacher contracts across the nation. For all intents and purposes, they might as well make the tiebreaker a best of five game of rock, paper, scissors. But sadly, even that ridiculous proposal would give teachers more control over their futures than under the antiquated seniority-based system currently in place.
You know, this is important for us to consider, Rick, because you and I have the same exact amount of seniority on this show.
Mm.
And if somebody came in here and wanted to do some budget cutting, I don't know how they would decide which of us would go.
I got to say, this thing going with the lower Social Security number, what's up with that?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense.
I mean, if you're going to go ahead and you're going to make an argument that you need to systematically remove teachers in a certain way,
mm-hmm.
dude, you've got to go with higher Social Security number.
Mm. am I guessing your last four digits starts with a 9?
No, it starts with a 0 now that I think about it. So maybe it's not.
So we're not using that for our system, okay?
So maybe that's not the most strategic call. But I'm just saying, my God, what kind of insanity is it where some districts are laying off teachers for having high Social Security numbers, and other districts are laying off teachers for having low Social Security numbers? That is a system that is not conducive to attracting or retaining talent. Okay. If you want to keep teaching talent, you've got to use consistent Social Security numbers across the board, and I'm saying it should be the high ones.
Okay, back to our issue here. I really think, in our case, it should have something to do with unexcused absences, okay? Because I have been on this show much more consistently than you have, Rick. Okay, so I'm just saying, if it comes down to you or me, they should ax your butt first.
Given my compensation on the show, baby, I am okay with that. The opportunity to cost to me is immense.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, thank you, Chris, for bringing us that.
Yep, good to be
on the
show.
There's other crazy things, too. I mean, a lot of, you know, they flip things. They had birthdays.
Oh, yeah.
Last names.
Lotteries, coin tosses.
The whole shebang.
Yep.
Yeah.
But again, if you want to go coin tosses, what we need is a national standard of it's all heads or it's all tails. You're not going to attract and retain talented teachers if sometimes it's heads and sometimes it's tails.
Oh, look who's in favor of a national standard now.
I'm in the Fordham studios. I felt a blush.
All right. That's all the time we have for this week. Until next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.